Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Sam Smart, and I'm hosting today's program, which is being recorded at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Colby Van Der Rey, rising senior at Aspen High School. She will be interviewing Casey Wong, professor of bioengineering and of microbiology and immunology at Stanford University. Professor Wong is a world-leading figure in the field of bacterial cell biology. He has acquired an international reputation for the interdisciplinary application of theory, computation, and experiments to tackle long-standing fundamental questions in our understanding of bacterial growth and shape. Take it away, Colby.
Good morning. Thank you so much for agreeing to this interview. I'll just start off for the listeners. Can you explain some of your educational background, where you did your undergrad, PhD, etc.?
Definitely, Colby, and thanks for having me on. This is really exciting. So I started off as a physics and math major at Caltech. For those of you who are not aware, Caltech's a small but very accomplished school in Pasadena in California. And I think one of the things I learned there was to try to embrace all the things that we don't know. You know, I kind of thought math and physics was the sort of thing where you could map out a road and kind of just keep walking. And throughout my entire career, I found that I keep taking these little dirt trails. It's almost like an allegory for being in Aspen, where you don't want to stay on the Rio Grande Trail the whole time. You want to kind of branch off a little bit. And that was actually what my PhD ended up being. I went to MIT, and I used computational tools to study how materials are built. And actually, one of the interesting aspects of how they're built is how they fall apart. And so part of my PhD was about how structures melt. And I ended up then doing a postdoc at Princeton later on. That's where I got introduced to the Aspen Center for Physics, where I fell in love with biology. You might be wondering why a physicist is in a bioengineering department. And I wondered that too. It's a strange place to end up. But what I realized was that there's so many ways that physics imparts understanding of how the world works. And biology is this great frontier where there's this feeling that maybe things are specially complex, but also there's kind of the hope that we can take that complexity and understand it in very simple ways, and hopefully in an engineering vein, then use that to benefit the world around us.
Brilliant. So you talked a little bit about how the center inspired you in kind of your switch over into bioengineering. So was there a particular question that inspired the switch that you wanted to solve or search for the answer for?
Yeah, you know, I think I have an answer to that, although I would caution you that every scientist, I think their path ends up looking like a random walk. but then in retrospect, they tell the story with these very concrete road signs. So my road sign that I'm kind of making up in hindsight was that I realized that, you know, when you look at any biological structure, be it a cell or a tissue or an organism or an ecosystem, there's this fundamental question of how do all these parts come together and build this really high functioning structure without having it go wrong a lot of the time? And, you know, the tools of modern biology are not equipped to answer this question. And so I'll give you an example. The very first problem I worked on in biology was how do proteins that direct the cell to divide properly end up at the right place at the right time? And I actually asked a biologist colleague, and they said, well, the way that protein X ends up at one place is because there's a protein Y that's already there, and protein X just goes and finds its buddy. And I said, okay, great. Well, then how did protein Y get there? And they said, well, there must be a protein Z that was there, and protein Y went and found its buddy. And I said, okay, well, let's ask, how did protein Z get there? And, you know, of course, you start to realize that maybe there's something we're missing. And in this particular case, it was something very fundamental about how the physics of the interactions between these molecules ended up in what we like to call an emergent property of the system, where you throw things together and they become more than the sum of its parts. And in this case, it's how bacteria end up dividing in the middle and not at the end or somewhere else where they might chop their DNA in half or end up with a cell that doesn't have DNA.
Very cool. And so I know a large portion of your research has been centered on bacterial shape. So can you explain what the importance of bacteria's shape in particular means to its function and like its underlying mechanisms?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, there's two answers to that. One is very fundamental. Like if I took you out into the rainforest for the first time and you saw all these animals, and then I said, you know, come home and describe those to me. One of the first things you would do is you'd say, oh, well, what do they look like? Because so much of what they look like is both an information and a function of what they're trying to accomplish. An anteater looks a certain way because it needs to get ants out of small holes, right? And it's the same for bacteria. In fact, the shape of the cell is so important that bacteria regulate their shape in some ways much better than any other organism on the planet. And when that goes wrong, you can have situations where the bacteria just can't function, both in a good and a bad way. For instance, there's a lot of cases where you can use disruptions of cell shape to get rid of infections because they're no longer as fit to compete with other cells. But it's also a really fundamental question about this topic of how do things get built, right? Like if I show you the blueprint of this building, that won't actually tell you how to build it yourself. But if I show you how to build one building, you might be able to build another building, or you might be able to design something completely new that uses those principles in a new way. And I think that's sort of what we've been striving for, to have this almost like guidebook for how to build not just cells, but collections of cells, ecosystems. And I think that's how I ended up in a bioengineering department, because once you start going down this rabbit hole, you start to realize, wow, there's like really powerful ways we can use this knowledge to do something maybe really new and useful as well.
Very cool. And in those new ways, do you anticipate a use of like intentionally having, I guess, for lack of a better term, misshapen bacteria, or being able to formulate other cells in that way to apply to a medical department or disease?
Yeah, that I think is a bit of the holy grail. But I'll give you a case study where it illustrates how little we understand at this point. And I think also how important physics becomes in a question like this. Because, you know, when you see something in nature, it's very instinctive to think, okay, that must be important. And we've been studying for a few years a bacterium called Bifidobacterium. It's actually a probiotic. You may have taken it at some point. One of the things that it has impacted your life in doing is it's one of the earliest colonizers of the infant gut. It's actually wonderful at processing human milk oligosaccharides that are in breast milk, and it kind of sets the stage for your gut microbiome for your future development. So without bifidobacteria, you know, you would in some sense be set off on the wrong path, and maybe you would get bacteria that you don't really want to colonize. Maybe you don't have the sort of ability to process nutrients the right way. But what's really fascinating about bifidobacterium is that the word at the beginning, bifid, actually means Y-shaped.
Huh.
And it's one of the only organisms that seems to take on a Y-shape in nature. And so one of the hypotheses that people put out was that being Y-shaped somehow is important, and in a good way for these bacteria. Maybe it enables them to form structures where they can sort of feel out the environment that they're in, or maybe it helps them to attach to other bacteria. But actually, we were able to use some of our knowledge of how cell shape is determined and how to disrupt cell shape to find that all of the genes that are responsible for making this Y shape actually indicate that being Y-shaped is detrimental, right? And so it seems to be a signature that something has gone wrong rather than something that the cells are trying to do. And I think that shift in our understanding is changing the way that we approach what we're trying to engineer into other bacteria in the gut. So you know, I think your goal is the perfect one, but I think like in most of biology, you have to be very careful about what constitutes a sort of the successful case studies in biology and what constitutes maybe things that have gone awry.
Absolutely. So you mentioned that the Y shape is actually detrimental to the bacteria. Does your research have a way of discovering which shape would benefit the or each particular bacteria the most?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that ties into why I'm here in Aspen right now. So there's a workshop on data science in biology. And I think that idea of having a physics workshop in data science would have been crazy 10 years ago, because I think there's this idea in physics that we want to try to find the basic, simple understanding. Like, I want to be able to tell you a story that explains why a plane can fly. I don't want to show you 10 billion data points for what happens to the wind around a plane, because that wouldn't really tell you how to use that knowledge. But in biology, there's also power in having those 10 billion data points, because in part, just like I mentioned before, we don't actually know what we're looking for yet. The plane, it's very clear. We want to understand what gets you airborne. With bacteria, with humans, with ecosystems, we want to first try to figure out what are the basic principles and questions. And that's where data can be immensely powerful. And in this case of Bifidobacterium, what we've been doing is to use some of the engineering tools that we've developed to generate these very large data sets that give us the patterns of how cells behave, to try to do exactly what you say, to say, well, what is the kind of right direction to be moving forward?
Very cool. And so in that interdisciplinary research intersection of engineering and biosciences, do you have any predictions for what we'll see moving forward or any different collaborations between the sciences?
I think that, you know, right now we're at this fantastic nexus of many revolutions that are taking place in science. Probably the one that everyone is hearing more and more about is AI, and that really is an area driven by the fact that we have so much data, and now we have new ways to use that data. But in biology, there are also these other revolutions that have taken place, like sequencing. You know, it was only 25 years ago that, you know, we had the great success of sequencing the human genome, and that cost billions of dollars. And now, you know, my wife has her full genome sequenced, and you know, we routinely will sequence at scales that would have been unheard of in the previous generation of science. At the same time, also, we're not just reliant on these sources of data. We're also being able to see the world around us in new ways. So imaging has become a really powerful tool where we can see things move at the molecular scale. And that has been such a big driver of our work in cell shape, to be able to take these questions about how the parts work together in the right way at the right time and not have to rely just on our ideas. We can actually see everything in action. And so I think part of the big challenge for the future, and part of the things you may be thinking about as you go to college, is how do you put all that together? And that has been where physics has been the nexus of science for now more than a century. How do you take chemistry and biology and environmental science and make a synthesis that tells you the principles that are going to allow you to then make the next scientific discovery?
So is part of that what influenced your research in microbial communities as well?
It is. You know, when you start asking, you know, about any organism, how does this work? One of the realizations you have is that you cannot put that organism in a box and really understand it. You have to have the context of the environment around it. And for bacteria especially, but it's just as true for humans and every other animal, you, you know, the social aspect of who is around you is really critical. And there is probably no other ecosystem on the planet like our gut, where, you know, it's sort of like there's an intersection in Tokyo where 10,000 people cross the street every time the light changes. And I've gone through that intersection and you are just packed like sardines. And amazingly, everything works. Everyone's able to get across the street before the light turns. And that's how packed the gut is. You know, everyone is just right shoulder to shoulder with their neighbors, and somehow they all have to work together in the right way. And that was very inspirational for us to ask, how can we start to dissect this the same way we started to dissect all of the crazy proteins that are inside a cell, helping to build that cell into a functioning organism.
Very cool. So what does that research sort of entail, and like, what's your process for looking at and isolating different micro communities?
Yeah. You know, what has been the tradition for the last 20, 30 years is to try to take the huge amount of diversity in microbial communities that exists in the world around us and use these powerful sequencing tools to make catalogs. And that's usually a great way to start in biology because, you know, most of what we understand about the rainforest comes from the fact that, you know, there were explorers who went and collected all the animals and drew pictures and said, oh, you know, this is what we now need to start explaining. But it's equally important then to take the next step and say, okay, now that we've got all of these parts and all of these lists, what are the rules? And maybe can we start to ignore some of the parts that are really only incidental to the questions that we really care about? And so a lot of our work has been trying to figure out, where are these big gaps? And one of the things, the very first problem that we started working on was motivated by the fact that almost everything that we understand about the gut microbiome is in studying poop. Because you can get poop really easily. You know, each one of us can produce a sample basically on a 24-hour basis. And but it's a little bit weird. It'd be like if I were telling you, I'm going to explain my trip to Paris by telling you what comes out of the sewer system in Paris. There's things that you might find like a greater quantity of like baguettes and good cheese than you would in an American sewer. But you know, you might wonder, is this really the full picture? And so I started asking, well, you know, what does it really look like inside? And how different is it to be, you know, up in your small intestine versus, you know, in your colon about to come out as poop? And no one seemed to know. And there was a very obvious reason for this, which is that A, we didn't have the tools to really get in there and sample. And B, we didn't really know what it would mean to write down a story for what's the spatial organization of the gut. We like to think of it as the biogeography. And so our very first project working with mice was to try to figure out both the way you tackle that question and what is the answer. And what we found was that we needed principles from physics and computation and statistics to even start to describe this very complicated system. But once we had a way to describe the system, like sort of a set of dimensions so that we could map where things were, we started to see that there were very simple principles. Like one of the things that was fascinating was that if you change the diet of the mouse, you went from having a lot of structure to the organization where you might have like a little town of one species here and another town somewhere else of another species, to having everything look like it was kind of mixed in a blender. And we don't know how that happens, but it's really fascinating to think that you can have this like complete restructuring of who is next to whom inside the gut just based on what we eat.
That's really interesting. So in the mixture, have you seen in your research at all whether they will reorganize themselves in a different pattern where there's still like a group over here, but it's just in a different order? Or
Colby, I think you are already ready to start, you know, your PhD. That's a great question. And I think it kind of gets down, that's a very physics perspective, right? Like if you make a perturbation, what's the way that that perturbation relaxes and how do you recover? And the answer is that we haven't yet found the answer to that. But in trying to answer that, we've come up with another tool. And so one of the problems with the study that I just told you about is that in order to look inside, we had to sacrifice the animal. And that's part of the reason why it's so challenging to work outside mice. But we really wanted to look at the dynamics of changes like this. And so one of the things that we've developed very recently is a small capsule device that can be swallowed by humans. And what happens is that it's like the size of a Tylenol, but inside is a silicone tube. And what happens is that as that tube goes through your gut during digestion, it sucks up material from inside your gut. And then it comes out in your stool, and we can analyze what was going on in all the different regions of your gut. And so this is beautiful because it's non-invasive. And so actually, literally right now, I have one inside me that's sampling. And we've been looking at what's changing over long periods of time to try to answer exactly this question. You know, we can do things like change diet and see how it works in a human, which is fascinating because it means we don't have to extrapolate from model organisms to try to understand what's going on inside us.
Wow, that's fascinating. So I'm pretty unfamiliar with the process it takes to create these new tools. So can you describe to me and the listeners what it takes to create these new technologies?
You know, I think it's different for every technology, but what I would say is the defining characteristic is that they often come from a collaboration between many people. In the same way that, you know, going to space or the Manhattan Project or something, it really requires many different perspectives. And I think that is something that's increasingly embraced by universities all over the world, that when you bring people together, they can start to identify a key problem and then like break it apart into the both the parts and the steps that are needed to get to that goal. And that was exactly how it progressed here. We said, we need something that does this, but we don't want it to be complicated. So for instance, there's no power source, right? So it's very easy to manufacture. And we need it to be cheap because we want to deploy it in lots of people. And we need it to be something that people aren't going to have a problem with taking. It needs to be easy because, you know, for instance, right now I'm sampling for many weeks in a row. Boy, it would be really painful if this ended up being a process that took large chunks of my day. But luckily, you know, it's just like, you know, taking a pill. You can pop one at night and then collect it, you know, collect one a couple days later. And I think once you put all of those goals into a coherent framework and then set lots of smart people trying to attack those, it starts to come together through a process of, you know, as you imagine, trial and error, where we found lots of ways things don't work, but that led us to the final product.
Very cool. Thank you. And as we begin to wrap up, do you have any pieces of advice for those looking to go into any field with interdisciplinary sciences or bioengineering?
Yeah, you know, what I tell all my students is that I'm training you not on the tools of today, but the way to ask questions using the tools of tomorrow. Because odds are, everything that you learn how to do now will be superseded by something better. We certainly hope so, right? And but there is never going to be a shortage of great questions in biology, especially, and in physics. But how to find the questions that are right for the tools that you have and right for you as a scientist is really tough. And I feel like that's a process I'm still going through. But as I get to experience it more with different people, with different backgrounds, I start to realize that there's like a flavor of question and a flavor of outcome that really appeals to me. And so the first question I ask every student when they join my lab is, what types of things excite you so that we can find those right questions. And I also tell them that if you think that you're making a choice for the rest of your life, get that out of your head now. Because if you just look around at all of the people here at the Aspen Center for Physics, they probably had no idea they would end up working on what they do now if you had asked them even 5 years before. And I think that's a really exciting aspect, that your roadmap for the future is going to develop in fascinating ways. And so, you know, as you think about college, I encourage you to just think about, you know, what does life look like after as well? Because you're going to train for becoming a scientist that gets to embrace everything I've told you and probably much more exciting things as well.
Wow. Thank you. And I guess, does part of that process of searching it kind of relate back to your experience here in Aspen with the different trails? I know you mentioned that link earlier. Do you have a favorite trail in town?
I love Cathedral Lake.
That's one of my favorites too.
You know, I always aim to go swimming in Cathedral, and I would say I chicken out about half the time.
Oh, it's so cold.
But, you know, what I love about Aspen is that every summer is different. And in part, it's because the center here has embraced the idea that things are changing and moving quickly. And so every time I tell someone about the center, they say, oh, well, like, what meetings can I expect to see next year or in 2 years? And I say, you know, get that out of your head. Think to yourself, how can I take these new frontiers and think about how that might impact me in 2 years, 5 years, 10 years? And so I look back now and I can trace things that we're working on now to a workshop that I came here to work on 15 years ago. And I think that's, you know, that's what makes this a wonderful place.
Very nice. Thank you so much.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank Casey Wong and our high school intern, Colby Van Der Rey. We hope you enjoyed this radio physics interview. For more information about our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org or follow us on our social medias at aspenphysics. Thank you.